you. Again, I'm Bob Kirkaldi, and I'm the project officer for the gonococcal isolate surveillance project, which you've probably heard several times about this week. And I thought for this talk it would be interesting to take a step back and talk about more about how we do surveillance of gonococcal susceptibility. You've probably heard multiple times this week about the threat of emerging cephalosporin resistance, and I'll certainly touch on that because that's one of the biggest problems we're facing in this area. But I thought it would be interesting to think about how we do surveillance and what are some of the challenges we're facing and how we can enhance it. So as an overview, I'm going to review briefly Neisseria gonorrhea antimicrobial resistance and then the rationale for it, the methodology that we currently use and that's been used in the past, and then review some of the past successes, some of our current challenges we're facing. Certainly there's a lot of programmatic challenges, but also some surveillance challenges and then potential future opportunities that may be available to us, and then I'll conclude. So as many of you know, and Sarah did a great job reviewing gonococcal infection, but as many of you know also, the organism has a remarkable ability to gain antimicrobial resistance. And we care about this because it undermines treatment success, heightens the risk of complications, and may increase infectivity in a population by facilitate transmission by lengthening the duration of infection. And the organism has demonstrated the ability to progressively develop antimicrobial resistance really since we started using these agents in the 1930s, either through genetic reassortment, and the organism has an amazing ability to reassort and move its DNA around and pull in DNA and extrude DNA and from other, both Neisseria and also other organisms. And when sulfonamides were introduced in the 1930s, the organism rapidly developed resistance to these agents. Penicillin resistance developed over the next several decades, as well as tetracycline resistance. And then, as many of you know, during the 2000s, fluoroquinolone resistance emerged in the U.S., first emerging in East Asia before moving globally. So after the emergence of fluoroquinolone resistance, or QRNG, then we were left with the one antimicrobial class, the cephalosporins, as many of you know. So why do we do surveillance for gonococcal susceptibility? So I think the big reason is really to inform treatment recommendations. This is an evolving organism, and the same treatments that we've used decades ago we can't use now. And also, many of us, the treatment for gonorrhea usually is empiric. We don't have often it's your arthritis or cervicitis we're treating. We don't know what the resistance profile is when it's being treated. And also, it's particularly important, of a heightened importance for doing surveillance now because of dwindling treatment options, as many of you know. And also, the other benefit of surveillance is to detect new gonococcal resistance patterns that emerge, and this also informs treatment recommendations. So if one were to step back and think, how would I design a surveillance system to monitor this? What would be some of the possibilities of where you would place your resources, where you would look for things? And this is sort of just a schematic that I think would be helpful. You know, would you look for clinical treatment failures, which you might be very specific for resistance but wouldn't be very sensitive? Also, you couldn't detect emerging patterns. Would you do antimicrobial susceptibility testing? Would you look for genetic mutations? Really, since some of the surveillance projects that have been done since the 70s and also with GIST, which I'll touch on, the focus has really been on antimicrobial susceptibility testing because that provides both sensitivity to detect emerging patterns before they really cause widespread clinical treatment failures, but also have the specificity to say that the organism actually is maybe having resistance within the laboratory. And also, particularly during the outbreak of PPNG, surveillance for clinical treatment failures was also conducted. So I'll touch briefly at the end. I know there's a lot of talk about the possibility for genetic surveillance of genetic mutations and molecular surveillance, and that was discussed really well at length yesterday, but I'll highlight again some of the opportunities and challenges for that. So how do we measure antimicrobial susceptibility testing? And I know this is something that you've probably heard much about this week, but I think it's helpful to understand how these things are done. Sometimes it's sort of a black box. So there's really three ways to do it, and they all require the culture isolate to actually grow the live culture to look at how it responds to the antimicrobial. And probably the quickest, easiest, and cheapest way is by disc diffusion. And this is where you have a culture plate, and you drop a disc impregnated with antimicrobials onto it, and you see what happens. So if you look at this first thing, this light gray is where the organism is growing, and these dark areas here are dead organisms. So what you hope to see are big, wide zones of dead organisms spreading away from as the antimicrobial spreads away from the disc, killing off all this bacteria. You know, here you see that you dropped the antimicrobial in there and it didn't touch the bacteria at all. And a similar mechanism, which is the E-test, which is a strip impregnated with antimicrobials at a concentration. So the light areas around the side are a live organism. The darker areas next to the strip are dead bacteria. And there's a gradation of how much bacteria there is. And actually, this is nice because it gives you a result called an MIC, which I'll discuss briefly. And then there's agar dilution, which is really the gold standard and is done in our reference laboratories for GIST, but is really laborious, labor-intensive. The E-test and the agar dilution both give us what's called the minimum inhibitory concentration, or MIC. And that's something you'll hear about during these talks about cephalosporin-resistant bacteria. And that's the lowest antimicrobial concentration that inhibits visible growth in the laboratory. And just as a brief aside, if we can get the slides to advance, here we go. I thought it's useful for me to conceptualize, at least, how we do agar dilution and what that means, what an MIC really means. So this is sort of an oversimplified way of doing it. But if you can imagine, if you're mixing a bunch of antimicrobial powder together and then you're adding water and making a solution, then you would say you could have a concentration of 1. If you dilute that further, so adding more water each time, you dilute it by half, you go to a 0.5 concentration, dilute it again with water by half, you have a quarter strength, 0.25, and keep diluting it down to a smaller and smaller concentrations of antimicrobial in your solution. And also, perhaps you're adding more antimicrobial solution and making it even more concentrated, and so you're moving up toward the side. And then the folks in the laboratory will make petri dishes, basically plates, of these really tiny concentrations up to very large concentrations, to which they inoculate the bacteria, a standard amount onto each one. And then they give it time, and they see what happens. Can the bacteria grow on a plate that has some antimicrobial in it, and what's the concentration? So you hope that it stays down at this far end, that you hope that a tiny amount of antimicrobial in your petri dish will kill off anything that's in there. So in this case, maybe it only grows at the first 2, so you'd say it doesn't grow at 0.125, so that's your MIC. That inhibits the growth. What we get concerned about is over time if we start to see that these bacteria can start to grow at higher and higher concentrations. And that's where we start to think, okay, this may be a problem. Resistance might be emerging. This is something we have to start watching for and start to be worried about. Now, one of the challenges is that Clinical Laboratory Standards Institute releases for different bacteria and for different organisms, what are the values that we're worried about? What are the ones that say this is resistance, this is not? And we don't have that for gonorrhea for the cephalosporins. What they say is that for cefixime and ceftriaxone, it's sensitive if it's 0.25 or lower, but then there's no other information provided. So what we extrapolate is what we call decreased susceptibility above that at the 0.5 and greater. Again, we're not sure at this point how this plays with clinical resistance, but some of the treatment failures that we've heard about do correspond with these 0.5 and 1 levels. Now, some of the data I'm going to show and that you've probably seen previously are what we call elevated MICs. So for surveillance purposes, we try to get out more on the leading edge and look for trends earlier. So for cefixime, we use a MIC of 0.25 and higher, what we call elevated MICs. And for ceftriaxone, which tends to have lower MICs, we use 0.125 and greater to look for trends. So in the U.S., the cornerstone of our surveillance is the gonococcal isolate surveillance project, and this uses the agar dilution to look for susceptibility testing. And as many of you know, this is a U.S. Sentinel surveillance system that monitors trends in gonococcal susceptibility. It's operating in 25 to 30 STD clinics, currently about 29 in the U.S., and urethral isolates are obtained from the first 25 men per site each month. Antimicrobial susceptibility testing is done by 4 to 5 regional laboratories, by agar dilution, as I described in a simplified way, and then confirmatory testing is done by CDC. And these are the sites that GISL operates. So we have broad geographic coverage relative to where most of the gonorrhea is in the U.S. in the south. Now, we oversample the west because with PPNG, with QRNG, that's where we've seen resistance tend to emerge first, sort of our early warning system. So GISP has been in operation since 1987 and has been hailed by some as a model sentinel surveillance system. And the reason for this is that, for two things, really, I think that GISP data have yielded insights into the emergence and the spread of resistance. And I'll show one example of this. These are some data that we presented last year at IDSA. And this is the percentage of isolates with elevated MICs or resistance by sex of sex partner over the last several years by different antimicrobials. And one of the things about that makes GISP such a rich source of information is we have the lab data. We also have it tied to epidemiologic data. So among men, among MSM and MSW, across antibiotics, resistance tends to be higher among men who have sex with men. And I think that has important implications that we're thinking through. And the other thing is what you hope for in a surveillance system is that will directly inform policy, at least action or at least policy. But GISP data has been highly successful at that. So as many of you know, with the emergence of QRNG, this graph shows the percentage of isolates that were 4-quinolone resistant, or QRNG, in the U.S. And you see starting in the early 2000s, the percentage increased, and such that in 2000, to a point that such in 2007, 4-quinolones were no longer recommended in the U.S. And that was a fairly large decision. It was based on GISP data that allowed us to watch this increase over time. And this also not just fueled a change in recommendations, but clearly a change in practice and prescribing behavior, too. These are data by Debbie Dowell using this STD surveillance system that you've heard about. And this looks at fluoroquinolone prescribing in 5 sites. And you see that after the release of the April 2007 treatment recommendations to no longer use fluoroquinolones, the percentage of patients treated with fluoroquinolones decreased significantly. So after the emergence of QRNG, we're left with the cephalosporins as the cornerstone of our treatment. And in 2010, the recommendations issued are for treatment of gonorrhea to be treated with ceftriaxone as a single dose, or if that's not an option, with cefixime, plus a second antimicrobial, either azithromycin or doxycycline. And so one of the important things we're facing now, as many as you know, is the emerging threat of cephalosporin-resistant gonorrhea. And we're concerned about this because of cefixime treatment failures that have occurred in Asia and also most recently in Europe, the identification of cefixime and ceftriaxone isolates in Japan and most recently in France, and increasing MICs in Asia, Australia, and also most recently in Europe and the U.S. And I'll highlight some of the data that we're seeing in GISP to describe what some of these challenges are. So these are data. This is the proportion of isolates with elevated MICs to cefixime from 2000 to 2011, the preliminary data, at least from January through August. And we see what we call MIC creep, increasing MICs and increasing proportions over time. And similar to what we saw with the emergence of QRNG, this increase appears to be predominantly in the West Coast, although we are seeing increases in the Midwest as well. So the West is seen in orange bars, the Midwest in the light blue bars, and Northeast and South in the light green bars. We're also seeing increases predominantly among men who have sex with men. seen here in the light blue bars. So this is the proportion with elevated MICs to cefixime by sex of sex partner. And we've seen slight increases among men who have sex with women, but really the increase has been pronounced among MSM. And in GISP, one of the things we note is we tend to oversample relative on the West Coast, and also that's where many of the MSM in our sample population come from. So sometimes it's difficult to tease out, are these changes regional, are these changes by sex of sex partner? And what we see in this case is that in these increases in MICs, it tends to be a phenomenon of both region and population. So these are data showing the data stratified both by sex of sex partner and region. And you see in the light blue bars that regardless of region, the MICs tend to be higher among MSM. And also regardless of sex partner, the MICs tend to be higher in the West. So, you know, in addition to increasing MICs, this is also increasingly alarming because it mirrors what we've seen in the past, with history repeating itself. MICs to ceftriaxone have increased slightly over time, too, with a similar regional and population pattern, although luckily the increase has been very slow and still relatively low. So clearly GISP provides useful information and will remain the cornerstone of surveillance. But we're at a time as we're seeing emergence of resistance to the last class of drugs that we have readily available, is we have multiple challenges facing us both in terms of surveillance and our responses to treatment. So though this is changing, there has been a relatively low awareness of the threat. I think there's some people in the community who forget that gonorrhea is still around, and certainly there are many people, even in the STD field, who haven't been aware of this growing threat. So I think some of the advocacy that we've been doing and a lot of the local state health departments have been doing has really helped. Now, one of the limitations, GISP has been fantastic at describing prevalence, describing trends over time, but one of the challenges is it's defined as a sentinel surveillance system and not as an early detection rapid response system. So if there is an outbreak, if there's one patient with a highly resistant ceftriaxone resistant bug that lands in Seattle, in San Francisco, in Portland, in Hawaii, we won't know about it immediately. So GISP is not sufficiently timely, may not be sensitive enough, because we sample about 4% of male cases. So while we can show trends over time that seem to be representative of at least of the STD population, we may not be able to detect that first case. So that may rely on local detection. But facing that, we're sort of a perfect storm because we're seeing declining local capacity for detection because we're losing culture capacity, which is necessary for susceptibility testing. And with that in hand is going declining susceptibility testing capacity. And as many of you know, budget cuts and other things are really weakening our public health infrastructure and the ability to follow up on these cases, and people are losing DIS for response. And again, we're facing fewer remaining treatment options, sort of heightening a lot of the anxiety. So in light of these challenges, and sort of not to be pessimistic or gloomy, but we do have multiple opportunities to strengthen surveillance. And I think one of the challenges is that I think one of the holes we can fill is trying to find cases more quickly to allow programmatic response and hopefully find and treat those cases and their partners. So if we're in terms of antimicrobial susceptibility testing, New York City has, as many of you know, started mandating AST reporting. And although most of their reports are coming from their public health clinic, I think it's a really interesting opportunity to get data outside of GISP about any other places, any other labs that are doing AST testing, and they can monitor those trends over time and look to see if there's any worrisome results, and they can try to find those patients or just monitoring for trends. And I think in light of this, I know it's increasingly challenging, but maintaining culture capacity, even if it's not done routinely, but the ability to do it if a lab needs to do it, I think is incredibly important. And then there's some interesting work and discussions being done with looking for, are there ways we can detect treatment failures if they occur, when those first cases of resistance pop up on our shores? So obviously the clinicians are on the front line for recognizing these things, so increasing awareness among clinicians and among the health departments and maintaining vigilance is critically important. We ask that if someone does recognize a treatment failure, either a clinician or a health department, that those cases should be reported to the health department and CDC wants to know about it. but that is a relatively passive system, relying on recognition and reporting. So there are some ideas being thrown around and even being implemented locally in some jurisdictions about considering maybe if there's sufficient concern or if there's an outbreak, maybe doing active test to cure as sort of a prospective look. But one of the things I think some people are looking at now is using case report data and population level data to look at their repeat cases. So often cases, if they're repeated from the same person within 30 days or 60 days, are thrown out as duplication. And I think some places, such as in Washington, I think now in New York City, they're starting to look at those cases to say, okay, these might be duplications, but let's look, because if a treatment failure occurs, it may present as a case that's reported 1 week and it's reported again from the same person a week or two later. So I want to conclude with this question that's been bandied around multiple times in the last year and been discussed recently. Is there a role for molecular surveillance? I know we all know that culture capacity is declining. There's widespread use of NATs, and NATs are a fantastic test. Is there a way to parlay NATs into increasing our surveillance? So, in addition to NATs, there's increasing access to genome sequencing, certainly not at the local level, but through academic partners. So, but some of the limits to molecular surveillance, and what I mean by molecular surveillance is as the microbe genetically changes, it's going to develop genes for resistance. And we look for those signs of resistance. But are there ways to look for the genetic changes that turn into the resistance? And with a lot of our molecular techniques, that's becoming increasingly available to us to look for the genes. Although the big challenge, I think, with doing this is that to do that requires a thorough understanding, first a recognition that the resistance has emerged, and then a thorough understanding of what the genetic basis for that resistance is. So potentially, these kind of maybe an assay or these techniques could help provide prevalence estimates of circulating mutations that are associated with well-characterized resistance. So perhaps they could look for PAR-C or GIRA or some of these resistance genotypes associated with QRNG. But just because of the basis of needing to go back retrospectively, they're not going to be able to detect newly resistant phenotypes, phenotypes being the actual, you know, clinical or laboratory resistance, because you don't know what you're looking for. So in my mind, I think the molecular surveillance is an interesting opportunity, both maybe for enhancing treatment choices or surveillance, but it will act as a supplement and will not be able to replace culture and susceptibility testing, if not even anytime soon. I'm not sure how it would do it at all. So in conclusion, I think it's important for us to recognize that cephalosporin-resistant Neisseria gonorrhea is an emerging threat, and continued surveillance, certainly through sentinel surveillance, is critical. And I think any efforts we can do to enhance surveillance is important. Culture and susceptibility testing, even though increasingly challenging, is still needed. And supplemental molecular surveillance and these kind of techniques, I think, are important to explore and to look at and figure out what we can do with them and how they can help us in the work we do. But they'll be a supplementation. And I think a call for enhanced surveillance locally to quickly detect the emergence of cephalosporin resistance is also warranted. So with that, I want to thank my collaborators, both at CDC and the excellent folks I've been working with in GISP, and also, importantly, all of the GISP clinics throughout the country who are there on the front lines and helping out, and the patients who've been kind enough to participate. So with that, I will open it up if there's any questions anyone has.
Are there any questions for Bob?
Hi. I think we've spoken on the phone.
Many of you in person at this meeting. I think it's more of a comment related to molecular testing, which is also what I for hosting a meeting at Masters in Public Health between some of your collaborators and our backyards at the Harvard School of Health, as well as Peter Rice's group, who's been working with the Chinese researchers at IFLIS. So that's happening tomorrow. related to bacteria gonorrhea. Because I think that most people postulate that gonorrhea is having sex with other organisms in the pharynx, for example. And the resistance determinants that it's treating are actually relatively well known with the other gonorrheas or hemorrhoids, or hemorrhoids in the, oral pharynx. So I wonder if with the advent of
I think the opportunities that are going to be available to us with whole genome, at least, you know, relatively whole genome sequencing, are pretty exciting. I think what, you know, potential opportunities would be knowing what's going on in other parts of the world, sequencing those, and then maybe looking for stuff that's coming on in the U.S. But I think it is challenging because I think the organism is so versatile that even with, I don't know if I have it here, but as I think about it, you know, we know that mosaic penne seems to be the cornerstone for the development of resistance for cephalosporin resistance. So here, if you can imagine, you know, this mosaic penne, which is a combination of the gene that creates the penicillin binding protein. And that seems to have shown up in a lot of the isolates that had decreased susceptibility. But we also find ones that have decreased susceptibility but don't have the mosaic penne. And also, there's a big heterogeneity about what mosaic penne is. I think one of the things that I found reassuring, so this is the big thing I worry about, is that, you know, we're looking for a mosaic penne, but then a different mosaic penne is going to pop up, you know, and we don't know. This is all like a, you know, a bunch of mosaic pennes, and some of these are associated with resistance, some of them aren't. We might have an assay that looks for a specific mosaic penne, and then different ones pop up. So that's one of my concerns, is that while we're looking in one place, there's stuff going on behind us. I think, you know, it's interesting, Mark Pandori in his talk yesterday talked about, in the work they're doing looking for an assay, actually found pretty good specificity about finding those. So, you know, I think it's a challenge, but I think even if we're focused now narrowly on cephalosporins, you know, next we'll be looking at gentamicin, gemifloxacin, you know, CEM-101, and we don't know what those resistance genotypes are going to look like. So I think there's always going to be a role, and maybe in conjunction, because doing, I think you can do it as a surveillance activity, looking for those things, but also maybe in the community, doing more genetic work that can expand the scope of it. But I just, you know, in my mind, don't see how to get around it. I think it's an important opportunity. I mean, it would be interesting to know if we had a point of care test that could look for some genetic markers, that could look for at least penicillin, tetracycline, fluoroquinolone, you know, some of the known markers at the point of care, and that can help. But I think that's still a ways off. But I think, you know, especially with the folks at Harvard doing collaborating on genome sequencing, I think it's really interesting. And, you know, the way we be doing treatment or surveillance may be quite different in 10 years. Thanks.
Any more questions?
One of our surveillance challenges, and we're noticing increasing since technologies have been increasing, is the use of online testing services. So is anybody aware of those issues in their space? Online testing services are clients can go online, find a facility near them, like a laboratory, go and drop a specimen and wait a couple days or whatnot, log that online and get the result. So there's a disconnect between provider and client. And so they can select the provider based on the services or go back to the healthcare provider. So with ELR, we've noticed it was, or Illinois, we've noticed the initial response that we were getting all these online testing services. And it took pretty much a year to finally get a better information from them. Because usually it's anonymous. We don't get sometimes, initially the lab results come as ID numbers, no demographics, date of birth, we do get. But usually the city, all that information is missing. So I noticed that it is a big concern for syphilis cases and HIV cases, because when local health departments seem to follow up, there's no information such as those. And probably from other states, if we get more video report forms from us, we usually have to write it's not our own testing service because this is all the information we get. So I'm noticing for, even though it's a small proportion compared to PMD reports, it is a big challenge for us. And I don't know if other people are getting that and how they are dealing with that.
Is there any other comments? Would you like to come up? Could you come up to the mic?
From the Ohio Department of Health. We actually have been dealing with that. I don't know the answer. I hope you guys can tell us. We do get a lot of reports from Illinois, and I'm actually not in surveillance anymore, but I used to be. And so my partners in surveillance have called these places. They are shady. The doctors deny being involved with them. We don't know what's going on. We need help with that. So if anybody...
One of the websites is DTTMD. We finally found the contact person who on a weekly basis does submit with his lab results the names of the clients because they have to rely on the billing information to get that information. But there are a few new websites that in this year that I have encountered that pretty much say, well, it's anonymous. And I know in part of our state laws, all you really require is a test result, not necessarily the client's name, but maybe a date of birth or whatnot. So that was the minimum amount, and that's as far as they would go in terms of submitting. The two websites that we had are now reporting more accurate information, but a lot of times we have issues that they just give, the client gives falsified demographics so that they don't have to be reported, but they will sometimes give at least an email. So one of the issues that I do get, I see some of these websites send it to other states, and those states send it to us, they lack a specific ID number. And all they have is DTC as the last name, and nobody can get off or follow up with that. So.
Any other comment or questions for Bob or for the rest of the panel?
Can I ask Lizzie a question?
Go right ahead.
Sure.
I was just curious too, and you had as one of the things of reconsidering metrics, I think one of the options. I was just curious talk about that or what you meant by.
Actually hoping someone in the audience would want to suggest a metric we should reconsider. The one I've been stuck on or bouncing around in my head is really trying to get a better handle on screening coverage. So okay. We've been focused a lot on the infections, but really screening coverage is, if we're thinking about program and what metrics we could use to inform and evaluate program, understanding who's being tested and not being tested, having that information would be really useful, I think.
Well, if there are no more questions, I'm going to bring this session to a close so you can all get to the final.